morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is a show where the subject is writing. If you're a fan of the written word, if you love to read, or if you love to write, this show is for you. Get comfortable, pour yourself a cup of tea or coffee, forget your worries and settle down. You're going to enjoy the show, I hope. My name is Linda Field. I'm your host. And I'd like to talk about some of the glitches we had in November. It was a very strange month. KVGC Studios moved last month. And so there were times when the studio was not available when I thought it would be. So I had to change times to record with my guests. And we got into a big mix-up. And as it turned out, there were two shows that I had scheduled to record that didn't happen. So remember when I asked you folks to send in your poems and short stories for Thanksgiving? Well, you never heard them on the air because we did two reruns of previous shows. You got to hear Kathy Isaac Luke again and Mara Feeney, but nothing about your Thanksgiving poems. I'm so sorry. I had work sent in from Jim Turner, Elaine Faber, Taylor Graham, Connie Corcoran, Margaret Duarte, and some other people, and it didn't get on the air. I really do apologize. I'm going to try to get some of them on today and others in the next two shows that I record before Christmas. I'd like to also, before I get to reading some of your work, I want to let you know I do have some good news, and that is that my website is up and running, and we have about 12 shows that are archived there now. So you won't hear every one of them yet that I've done, but pretty close. There are 12 shows on there, and you can go listen to them by going to www.manzamedia.com. That's manzamedia.com. And there is also a link to my blog, and in my blog I have a little article that I wrote about a great play that I saw in Sonora. It's by Rick Foster, and it's called Women of the Bear. It's a three-act play with three different women speaking in each part, and it was just phenomenal. I really enjoyed it. I don't know if it's being put on any other place right now, but you could look up Rick Foster, and if you ever get to see the play advertised, be sure you go see it. It's a very moving, compelling play. Also on my blog, I have a photograph of my last year's Christmas tree, since we're coming into that season. It's kind of an unusual tree because I was moving at the time, and I delayed too long in going out to buy a real Christmas tree. And I was having a party, and I had to get kind of inventive with how I was going to decorate my living room. So go to my blog and check out my Christmas tree. I think you'll get a kick out of it. I also have some new email addresses. You know, my website is manzamedia.com. You can, just to keep it easy to remember how to contact me with email, you can try linda@manzamedia.com. And, of course, the old email address, writers@kvgcradio.com, still works as well. Okay, well, now I want to read some of this poetry that was sent to me. This first part is by Jim Turner, and he wrote a short poem about the day after Thanksgiving. Lamp posts overnight have sprouted tinsel, plastic green and styrofoam candy canes. Downtown shops long since have dressed themselves as Christmas cards in motley frippery and artificial snow. Not to be outshone, my orange tree grows brightly with homegrown ornaments. Yeah, Jim, sometimes nature is much better than what we can come up with. He also sent a poem about December, and since this is airing in early December, let's try this one. This is kind of a sad poem. It's called Dreamer Without a Dream. On the sidewalk, paved with December ice, he is frozen by the window's yellow glow, mellowed to amber by paneled walls, giving back the firelight's playful dance. Soft warmth caresses silver and crystal. Blue china napkins in rings like wreaths adorn white linen spread upon a table. It is apparent that guests have not arrived. Polished dark wood chairs sit empty. Wait. Exquisite, she enters for a final look at the settings, moves the poinsettia an inch. Sleepless cold and hunger take their toll. He sees himself walk in, watches himself approach her, embrace her, possessive from behind, and kiss the cheek turned to him, where he stands, hopeless in the snow, nowhere to go, a dreamer without a dream. Thank you, Jim. Those were really nice. And I also have one from Connie Corcoran. Connie must be a musical person. The title of her writing is November Sonata. And not being that musical, I had to look it up. A sonata is a musical form that has three sections or movements, and they're often followed by a coda. And that will help you if you're not musical and you hear this. It has several parts. November Sonata. Overture. On a bright, chill morning, the still air listens for absent creatures gone to winter burrows. Cowbells clank in a frosty field. A chainsaw rips in the distance. Pie tins strike the freezer lid. Heels knock floorboards as the kitchen door bangs shut on a broken spring. Pumpkin, apple, and tart cherry pies wait outside the kitchen din for the hush of dark, when cups will scrape china saucers and chatter blend with a crackle from the potbelly stove. White gold forks prick a last crumb. First movement, 1958. Women's voices rise and fall, conducting preparations. Cheesecloth rubs polish on silver. Crystal pings softly the lace and linen on oak. Turkey drippings pop. Pot lids rattle. Water runs off steel slashing potato skins. Tires crunch on gravel. Car doors slam. Hi, sis. Here is some bread and butter pickles. George and Ann will be here soon. Hey, Johnny, catch. The leather football slaps a palm. Ice cubes drop in goblets. 21 chairs scrape wood on wood. Bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts. Refrain. Pass the potatoes. Are there more potatoes? Could I have the potatoes, please? Who ate all the potatoes? Second movement, 1995. A young father winks, dons his frilly apron on a 200-pound frame, and turns up the TV. He grins a melody. Me and Kyle were just down in the swamp chasing water moccasins. We're going to take the 49ers to the Super Bowl all by ourselves this year. Mom has her new stocking cap all ready to go. A heavy pot clatters in the sink. 10 pounds of the potatoes thud on the counter. Water splashes off the knife blade as he washes, peels, and dices. 14 chairs bump table legs. Bless us, O Lord. Refrain. Pass the potatoes. Are there more potatoes? Could I have the potatoes, please? Who ate all the potatoes? Third movement, 2005. The first daughter received a framed copy of her Uncle Chris's famous potato recipe as a wedding present from the widowed aunt. It is the only decoration hanging in her kitchen. She calls in tears from her in-laws. Mom, they're not having any mashed potatoes. The second daughter's fiancé declined his grandpa's invitation. They don't make a big deal about holidays. No mashed potatoes, he cried. Six chairs addressed the table. Cadenza, 2008. Cold fog drips in the dusty dooryard. Muffled cowbells clank their lowly note. Echoes across the canyon below. Fire snaps and whispers in the wood stove. The house creaks in quiet listening. A chainsaw rips in the distance. Two chairs wait at the table. Thank you, Connie, for your November sonata. Now it's my pleasure to announce who my guest is, and we have just about 2 minutes to talk, Naida, before we get started, and we'll have to break in just a moment. But I have the pleasure of having as my guest today Naida West, one of my favorite writers.
Oh,
welcome.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here, and I am honored to be able to talk on a local radio station to the amateur public out there. I love the radio.
Oh, yeah, it's great, isn't it? And Naida lives in Amador County.
Well, I live just over the border. Sorry to say Sacramento County, but I feel Amadorish.
Yes. Well, I guess you feel Amadorish because you write a lot about Amador County.
Yes.
This lady is... If you haven't read anything by Naida, I'm going to assign that you go out there and get one of her books and find it and read it. She will tell you so much about this part of the country. It's just incredible, the history that this woman has written in the form of historical novels.
Well, thank you. It is my point here, I guess, in this 25 years of solid writing and talking to the public and doing different things about writing and about my writing, to tell the story of California through this part of the country, because it was where we think our history started. Yet I start, my first book is with the native people, because they were strong, they were powerful, they were what was here, they were Californians, and they still are. This is something we often forget. And so my narrator is a native Californian who had the misfortune of looking back, and so her spirit is still in an oak tree. And she spoke to me in many ways as I was beginning to write, and she narrates my entire trilogy all the way up through about 1910.
Yes, and her name is Hauchia, isn't it?
Right.
She's one of my favorite characters in your books. Well, we're going to come back and hear more about Hauchia and your books in just a moment. Please stay tuned. We'll be back very soon. Back, you're with Manzanita Voices, and I'm Linda Field. Our guest today is Naida West. And during the break, Naida was telling me about her name. And it has a kind of an interesting story behind it. Her mother was a music fan. And did your mother play a musical instrument?
She was a professional pianist.
Oh, my goodness. Then I guess so. And so Naida... Her name is spelled N-A-I-D-A, and tell us how it came to be.
Well, it's not... I was just named all my life. I heard... Because, of course, I was interested in my name. Nobody could spell it. Nobody could pronounce it.
Okay.
So I used to ask my mother, why did you name me this? And she always said, well, it was just somebody in town when you were born. And I never got... to the bottom of it, but one thing I am pretty sure of is that I was named Aida with an N on it, Naida. There was somebody in town with an N on it. So, but the opera Aida was, I'm sure, one of a major reason for this, because my sister's name is Marguerite, and that was a character in the French opera Faust, Dr. Faustus. The main character, the female character, was in the French version, Marguerite.
I see. I remember when I first met you years ago, and I heard your name, I couldn't remember how to say it. I'm terrible with names anyway. And finally I got you to pronounce it for me again, and it was Naida, and I finally learned it. But if you had told me that you were named after the opera Aida,
then
I would have had it.
Well, see, I should do that more often. Yeah, about 85% of the people call me Nadia.
Yes, I've heard that a lot, Nadia.
And sometimes when I send in materials to a newspaper or a program of some kind, of the official program, and I'm asked to look to make sure everything's correct, I see my name spelled wrong, I will correct it. And then once in a while, it comes back not corrected after all.
Yeah.
Many's the time that I have sat out at a public event with a beautiful sign made with my name spelled wrong.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, well people are used to the name Nadia. I've heard that.
Right. But actually Naida is a well-known and established name on the other side of the world.
Oh, there you go.
From northern Russia all the way down, it's a big wide swath all the way down through the Balkans and into the Arabic countries.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Oh, amazing. Well, now, Naida, you spent some time, you grew up in Iowa.
Idaho.
Idaho. There we go again.
Yeah.
Another two similar names, Idaho and Iowa.
Very different places.
Very different, yes. And you also went to school for a short time in Montana.
Yes. Well, I went to school all over the place. I was sort of farmed out to relatives. And some of them were in Montana. Those were my mother's parents and her brothers and sisters. We had a big cattle ranch there, and I spent a lot of time on it. And some of that will show up in my final book in my California trilogy, Rest for the Wicked.
Oh.
You'll see some of the kitchen and, you know, how it was in such a place.
Okay. And then, but then you went to high school in Carmel.
Yes, it was. Well, for people have to understand, we were in uproar the early part of my life, partly in the beginning because of the war, and my father was stationed in California. Actually, my mother went to visit him there, and actually left us with her parents for some years, and then we went to Texas to see him, and then when they got divorced. We were individually farmed out to different places, and I went to generally to one of the one or the other of my grandparents, and they were both these were farmers with just the regular farm with the cows and the chickens and the pigs and the row crops.
I would love that.
Yes. And the other one was this big cattle ranch in Montana.
Oh, I see.
And while there, I went to school in two different schoolhouses. One was a one room with eight grades, and the other was a two room with eight grades.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Wow. I think you and I had sort of similar school experiences.
And then when they finally got completely divorced, my mother took us to California, to Carmel. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me, although I was terribly upset at the time and was trying to jump out of the car. She didn't tell us that we were moving permanently. She told us we were going for a ride, and we did go for a long ride.
A long ride. Oh, my goodness. She wasn't very forthcoming, was she?
No, I think she knew I wouldn't want to leave my dad.
Oh, I see. Well, then, after you graduated from high school in Carmel, you went to Germany, and you worked there for a while.
Yes.
And the whole time you were in Germany, you were immersed in German. You never spoke any English over there.
Right.
When
I first went to Germany, I was an exchange student.
Oh.
It was a summer exchange student program, the AFS, American Field Service.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I was very proud to be selected. It was a competitive thing, and I learned a lot of German at that time. I was with a family where most of them spoke English, but the mother did not, and I determined that I would learn German. And I met people there who I admired, and after high school graduation, I decided to go to the University of Munich. In fact, I had won a prize among the American students who went to Germany that summer, and the best, I had learned the most German.
So, wow.
I thought I could do this. Well, I was surprised when I got there to find out that I was 18 years old and kind of stupid the way 18-year-olds can be. I had carried all my cash, money with me, and thought, oh, later I'll get to the bank and exchange it. Every dime of that was, every penny of, every pfennig of it was stolen.
Oh, no.
So I spent a great deal of time trying to survive, get a job in an economy where Americans were not supposed to, this was post-war, Americans were not supposed to work in the American concerns, like the American Army. We were occupying Germany, so there were a lot of jobs and, you know, PXs and so forth, but I was not eligible because I was an American citizen.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was part of the treaty. Germany needed employment, and that no Americans would be hired in these jobs. These would be German citizens.
So you needed to get a job in a German establishment.
Right. I had to get a job in the German economy.
Wow.
And finally, after a string of them, I was an interpreter in Frankfurt for the Indian government, the East Indian government. They needed help translating from German to English.
Uh-huh. Well, perfect. Perfect. You were really suited for that. Now, when you came back, you went to Berkeley. You got a degree at Berkeley and then a degree at Sac State.
The first thing I did was go back to Idaho and live with the grandma I loved the most, and I knew she would heal me. It was a little bit of a hard thing for a girl. I couldn't even send a letter or make a phone call. With zero money, you have to survive somehow until you figure all this out. And
how long were you in Germany?
I was actually there for a year and a half.
Oh, my goodness.
In those days, you couldn't just pick up the phone, and there was no email. It was
no.
A very long way away. And so
you must have gone through some very bad times.
It was really difficult, and I had my money stolen a second time, too, but under much worse circumstances. But anyway, I finally made it back and wanted to go live with my grandmother Smith, who I admired, who was the great inspiration in my life in many, many ways. She was from Scotland, an immigrant to this country, funny lady, a remarkable human being. In fact, I wrote with my uncle, we wrote the book Simon's Daughter, which is about her life. But anyway, that was my first year. Then I went to Berkeley. I was back on my feet emotionally. I went to Berkeley and got a degree in sociology and carried on then at CSUS and got a PhD at UC Davis much later after having children.
I see. How many children did you have?
I have three.
Three? How wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, you were certainly were a very busy person. You had a lot of experience traveling around the country and the world. I think that's fabulous, but it must have been, I can imagine, doing all that alone must have been very hard. Now, so you are a sociologist. Are you also an anthropologist?
Well, I'm not an official anthropologist, but I was interested in that, and I probably would have majored in it if I'd thought there were any jobs. If I had been had a crystal ball and
yes.
seen that that the EIRs of the world, the environmental impact reports, always require a section on anthropology. Now, this is the full, the full employment for anthropologists that was not there when I was originally starting into. My career. I thought I would teach sociology. I'm so glad. Well, actually, I did teach it for a while, but I'm glad that I got out of it and I'm doing the thing I love the most now. But it's relevant because even the anthropology is relevant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, certainly.
When I was in the honors course in anthropology there, I was shocked to find that the only question asked, there was only one question asked in the for the test, the end of the course, and it was, what is the nature of social change? And what they meant was, in anthropology, going from primitive to modern.
Oh.
And this is a very deep question.
Very deep. You've written many books about it.
Yes, we had 1 hour with a pen and a little blue book to answer this question. And I knew that there were certain theories that you had to deal with, and Marxian and others, and it was a very frustrating hour for me to try to answer that question, and I joke with people today that I'm still answering it.
I think you are, yes, and I think that exam question is appropriate because you have spent the rest of your life answering it. I have read most of your books and enjoyed every one, and I've learned so much about the people and the places here. It's just wonderful. We have to stop again for a few minutes. We will be right back with Naida West. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're here talking with Naida West, and we've been beating around the bush a lot. I want to get right to talking about her books because she has such wonderful books, especially this trilogy of the history of California that starts with The Eye of the Bear, goes to River of Red Gold, and finishes with Rest for the Wicked. And Naida, you did not write these in that order, did you?
Yes, I did, actually.
You did?
But they were published in a wrong order.
Oh, published in the other order. Okay. Because River of Red Gold was published before
First.
Eye of the Bear.
Yes.
Okay. Eye of the Bear is about the Native Americans before they were, when they had a normal life and before they were so disrupted
when
by the
were,
arrival of the
When
Europeans.
They were the powerful people here.
Yes.
But it also has Estanislao, he's a native person, Padre Duran, Mariano Viejo, Jedediah Smith, and Russians from the Fort Ross and others. And I slip into their points of view once in a while just to give a feel for this.
Sure, because the history is so diverse and it all comes together. Mm-hmm. People from all these places have come together, and we've got the missions being built, the Indians being enslaved.
Although they didn't know the word and they didn't understand that.
No, of course
until
not.
Until they had to learn it.
They certainly lived the situation,
people,
though.
Yeah, here they would come out of the wilderness and sign up, they would happily, wanting to learn, wanting to be part of this incredible discovery over here on the coast, that people were sort of like spirit people. I mean, they could ride the backs of animals that had never been seen before in this country, part of the country. That's true.
Uh-huh.
Californians did not see horses till long after they did in other parts of the country. But we were isolated here in California by high mountains and deserts and so on.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, they wanted to be part of that. They wanted to learn about steel and iron and clothing and different kinds of technology. So it was a shock to them to learn that they weren't allowed to leave. But when they started to...
I mean, when they came to a mission, and they voluntarily came to a mission, then they wouldn't be allowed to leave.
Well, the thing was, if you were baptized,
mm-hmm.
a Christian,
hmm.
then you belonged to the church. You were a neophyte. You were going to learn about the church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were free to leave if you were not baptized. But then again, you wouldn't learn the magic. You wouldn't learn... You couldn't participate in this unless you were baptized. That was made clear. And one of the interesting things is the native people in our part of the country did not paint. Their art forms were music, basketry, and other, especially music. That was their big art form. When they went to the missions, there were beautiful paintings on the walls. And one of them was in Mission San Jose was, and I think most of them had a portrait of Maria, Mary,
mm-hmm.
Mother of God. And she would be portrayed as flying upward.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
In other words, she was going to heaven. Now, in the 8 days in which you were supposed to learn Spanish and understand Christianity before you got baptized, it was a very hard thing to do, to figure out what was being said here. And there was so much magic involved with this flying. But it seemed to them that this was a great power. You know, there were powers involved, bigger powers than they had run across earlier. So one of the powers would be to fly. And who wouldn't want to do that? And it seemed to them that, yes, if you get baptized, you will also go to heaven, but then you're missing the fine print there. You have to be dead first.
Oh, and yes. They didn't understand that.
Yes, it's hard.
Oh, my.
Well, this is where, of course, I understood better German than they understood Spanish, but it's very difficult in a place where you are surrounded by a foreign language and not allowed to speak your own language.
Mm-hmm. That's true. They were not allowed to speak their
own language. Understand the intricacies of Christianity.
Yeah, well,
so they became properties of the church.
Yeah. Hmm. Very sad.
Mm-hmm. And then they weren't allowed to leave. So.
No, they were not allowed to leave. And all of that is documented in Eye of the Bear in such a beautiful way because, as I said, we mentioned Hao Chia before. She was a woman who was one of your earlier characters in the book, and you follow her and her life and her family all through this book.
Yes, throughout the entire trilogy, actually, all the way up. And what I did there was take a walk one evening. I did every evening at my place. You can go out in the back, and you are in a place that seems like it hasn't changed for 1,000 years. And I enjoy that so much, just the quiet of it, and the way it looks, the way it feels. And could I read a
Please
little from
do.
This? Because
yes.
This is the first book, and it was written first.
Okay.
Now, this is the prologue, how Chia speaks.
Okay.
It is still here in the blue oak forest. Heat hangs in the branches. The end of day holds its breath. No woman banks a supper fire. No child sings. My people are gone. But I am still here, tight within this oak. In my roots I feel the faint tremor of approaching footsteps and then see the woman and her dog coming over the hill. They live nearby with their man, not in a village as we lived, but by themselves. She often comes here at the end of day and walks the path I once walked. Lately I've begun to imagine talking to her. Her footsteps slow as she approaches, and then she stands still, maybe enjoying the first cool ground air rising around her bare legs. She looks at the softening colors in the forest and the wing people leaving one at a time for their nests. The large golden dog sniffs through the tall grass beside the path, detecting the crossed trails of rabbits, raccoons, deer, skunks, mountain lions, and coyotes. To my surprise, I hear the woman's music. I have never heard it before. Like a theme from a once familiar song, it flutes of her joy to be in the forest as one of its inhabitants. I can feel it opening the barrier between us, though she doesn't know I am here. I try to speak to her. Only a tremor in my upper leaves marks my effort as though a phantom breeze blows upon them. Hearing the rustle, she looks up and sees leaves moving against the sky. The dog returns and sits at her feet, also looking up. All other leaves in the forest are still. Darkness is settling in the shadows, but she is not afraid. Her music continues to invite talk, head-to-head talk, as my people used to say. The dog also knows a friendly presence is near. I am a mother, I say, hoping to convey much more. I think you are a woman who lived here a long time ago, the woman says, before people like me came. Gently, so as not to insult her, I point out, yes, I lived here long ago, but I am still here. When I died, I looked back, unable to turn away from this home place that I love, and that is why my spirit lodged in this tree. It pleases me to come out of my solitude and talk with you. It pleases me, too. Who were you? Once I was Eagle Woman, I reply. I'm glad you want to know who walked this path before you. In a flash of clarity, I realized that she could tell the story of my son, the story of my people. We didn't know our storytellers would die, and since the survivors didn't look back or speak the names of the dead, their grandchildren never heard the story. Next time I die, I shall look forward, as they did, and walk the pathway of ghosts. I will sit at the campfire and tell my people how my son fought the Españoles, but that might take another 300 tree sleeps. The eagle in me grows impatient. Tell the story of my son, I say to the woman. She responds quickly, I do not know you. I know nothing of your people. I know nothing of your son. How can I tell your story? I think you can. But I am not of your people. One of them should tell the story. They are gone now, but this is your home place too. You love the river and the hills and the boulders as I do. I hear your music. You are a spirit sister. Tell me, tell my son's story. I'm afraid I wouldn't tell it right. Defeat that fear and you will tell it well enough. In the darkening shadows, she is suddenly uncertain she has heard me, and yet unwilling to break the link. It would take a long time to do this well, she says. It would change my life. While she stands there, thinking, guessing correctly that my people left no records, I greet the dog. He says he enjoys these evening walks, especially the smells and sometimes the chase. I tell him dogs have enjoyed walking here since the time of the ancients. Maybe I can do it, the woman says, but I will need to talk to you often. Will you be here? I smile in my grain. I cannot leave until my roots wither and my wood dies. Sometimes these oaks live a thousand rainy seasons. We can talk whenever you come. I will be back, she says, turning towards her house with the dog at her side. Osemite, who has been standing in the shadows, steps onto the trail. It is nearly dark now, and she blends with the umbels of the oaks on the hill behind her, and I can smell the richness of her fur. That will be interesting, says Osemite, pointing her snout after the departing woman. I think she can do it, I say. Are the new people interested in our stories? We shall see. Osemite ambles over and sits on her haunches behind, beneath my branches. Now, I'm going to quit reading there, but she is Osemite, the character here on the front of the book.
Osemite.
Mother Grizzly.
The bear. Oh, I was thinking of, I was wondering, it must be a coyote. Osemite is the
Mother
bear.
Grizzly. And that word is pronounced differently up and down California by the Miwok people. Sometimes it's Ozumaiti.
Ah.
Other times it has a slightly different accent. But the people here in the far northern range of the Miwok, which includes Amador County, were more likely to say Ose instead of Oz. The S's are S's and the not Z's.
I see.
Now, that voice of Hachia carries on, but it is mostly interrupted by the historical story of what's going on.
I see. And that's how it all got started. And the woman, of course, is you.
Is me. And that happened to me.
And that happened to you.
Yes, it did. And it was one of the most spiritual experiences I've ever had. And it did change my life completely.
Uh-huh.
I quit my other work. I've devoted my entire time to this.
Beautiful. Just beautiful. Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. Naida West. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. Naida and I have been talking up a storm during the break, and I don't think we're going to fit everything in that we need to talk about, Naida. There are a couple things I want to say really fast, and one of them is you were talking about the Mother Grizzly, whose name was Osemite,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is where the name of Yosemite National Park comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Mother grizzly.
Mother grizzly. Not bears in general, not even grizzly bears in general, but mother grizzly. The most powerful animal on earth to the native people, because she would defend, she was a powerful animal, but she would fight to the death to defend her cubs. And you didn't want to get between them. And even the bigger male, who had a different name in Miwok, was not considered quite as powerful because he wasn't willing to fight to the death.
I see. Oh, okay.
Except maybe for his own life.
You know so many things about the flora and fauna of this area. It's just amazing. Also, the tree that Haochia, mm-hmm. her spirit has inhabited, is a tree that is on your land. You and your husband bought a ranch on the Cosumnes River,
mm-hmm.
Back in the 90s.
30 years ago.
And did you know that you were going to write when you bought that ranch?
I knew nothing about this. I knew absolutely nothing about this. It was like magic pulled me into it, and it became my life.
And you really did go out walking with your dog.
I did, and I felt that happened to me, and there was nothing in my life to compare to that, the feeling of it. But I felt that it was a friendly presence, and I went straight back. At first, I went straight back to my computer, and I wrote what became the prologue of my next book, which is River of Red Gold, and the one that was actually published first.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And it was Haochia speaking, and it was the way what I thought she was saying.
Yeah.
Once I was Eagle Woman, when I walked these paths, and so on. And so, yeah, it's been a long and interesting.
Do you feel as if you were chosen to do this?
I can hardly believe that there wasn't something happening there. And there are many examples. I could sit here and tell you 3, 4, 5, 6 different things that happened that just seemed like couldn't possibly have happened. Things in my writing that I thought were pure fiction that ended up not being pure fiction when I learned more about it.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Well, and even just the fact that you and your husband chose that particular piece of land to buy.
Well, it wasn't. That was kind of a miracle, too. Actually, it's within the bounds of Rancho Murrieta, but not part of it.
Hmm.
He was golfing before they even had houses built. I mean, they built the golf course first. Hit the ball too hard. He's a very hard ball hitter. Went way out of bounds.
Hmm.
And he climbed the fence, and he was hunting for it, and all he found was a sign upside down. He picked it up, brushed it off, and it said for sale.
Oh, my goodness. Haochia put it there.
And that was its only advertisement.
Oh,
it had been for sale something like 8, 9 years, and nobody had bought it. Well, you can kind of understand it was not well advertised.
No, I guess not. Whoever had it for sale maybe was kind of half-hearted about wanting to sell it.
Well, they were the people that had
been waiting for you.
They had been on that property since 1853 or so. And they were lots of them, several generations. And they were, they didn't always get along well with each other, but they had decided that this was going to be for sale. And once they finally settled on a price, they didn't want to get back together and work on it, even though there had been inflation going on at that time.
Oh,
and it was an excellent price for us.
How fabulous.
That was sort of magical in itself.
So you have a small ranch, you have animals, a few animals.
Mm-hmm.
And
horses, goats, we've had goats and dogs,
dog
cats.
And you have this marvelous tree. Where the spirit
Well, the tree isn't actually on our property. It's right in the river bottom, which is part of Rancho Murrieta's public land property.
And also there, you found the ruins of a cabin there.
Yes.
That had been lived in by a famous person. In fact, you've already mentioned her, I think, today.
Mm-hmm.
Elitha Donner.
Right, from the Donner Party.
Yes.
And that was, you see, for me, I thought it was enough of a story when I heard about the shootout there between Jared Sheldon and the miners, probably the first shootout in California where people died over the use of water. I thought that was an amazing story, and I thought that was going to be the focus of my book, River of Red Gold, red meaning red in all kinds of ways, including bloody. But then when I was interviewing the great granddaughter of Jared Sheldon about it, I learned that her great-grandmother, the teenage girl who had married Jared Sheldon, felt sorry for that Donner girl, she said. And I discovered by asking her, I didn't mean to, I thought, oh, it's not what we're talking about, we're supposed to be on a different subject, but it turned out that
That Donner girl,
I said, do you mean D-O-N-N-E-R? And yes. You mean the Donner part? Yes, well, did she live around here somewhere, I asked. And Ellen Rosa, who was a descendant of Jared Sheldon, said, yes, she lived where you live.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's how I learned that. And that's when, and I had remembered then the old floor, the clay floor with a flat river rock pressed into it in a shape of a, you know, rectangle.
Mm-hmm.
I realized what it was.
It was the floor of Eliza Donner's cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your account of the Donner Party is absolutely the best account I have ever read. And the Donner Party has always fascinated me because of the tragedy and the desperation that those poor people went through. And also afterwards, how they were ashamed of their ordeal when they'd already been through enough. Yeah. They shouldn't have been ashamed.
Yeah.
But
especially the women, because they were held to a higher standard than men. They were supposedly not crass. Oh, there were two kinds of women. One that might eat human flesh, but you know what, we know what kind of women those must be. And then the others were angelic supposedly and would die first. See, so they were not. That's true. The aftermath of the Donner Party was not talked about in my schooling. I never heard about what happened to them later at all. The story always ended when some of them were rescued. That was it. So mine begins. The Donner Party part of that story, River of Red Gold, begins when they're under the snow, hoping to be rescued, not really believing that it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on.
Yeah, and the tale you tell, that I'm sure is very accurate because I've seen the research you do, it's incredible. The tale you tell about their ordeal and their rescue and the people who saved them, and the young Indian boys who tried to help guide them out,
and yet were killed and killed for the purpose of being eaten.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's why some of them survived. Otherwise, they all would have died up there.
That's
because
right.
Nobody knew they were there.
Well, it's a fabulous, fabulous account, and for that reason alone, I recommend River of Red Gold. It's riveting, and the whole book is riveting. And also another, we're never going to get to talk to about Rest for the Wicked, which is the book that you wanted to talk about today. But you're just going to have
my
to
new
come
book.
Back.
My new book, the one that won a national award.
You're going to have to come back. But
just recently.
Another reason to buy her books is every one of these historical novels has end notes at the back. And reading the end notes is as fascinating as reading the novels, because
it's like nonfiction attached to the fiction.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. She gives a list. For instance, in Rest for the Wicked, Naida gives a list of the people who are fictitious
mm-hmm.
characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next 10 or 20 pages or so are in-detailed descriptions of places and people who are in this book that are real.
Right.
And they're all around. If you live in the Sacramento, of course, Naida, maybe you don't know this, but we've got people listening in New York and Arizona.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
In Arizona. And we've got my friend Nancy up in the state of Washington right now. And people all over the country are listening to this, and I'm just sorry for you folks that you can't come and check all this out, because...
Oh, they can, though. They can go to my website and see my books. And
yeah.
I have many, many fans in New York and the East Coast, and the people are requiring my books in far-flung places like Duke University. And,
oh, good. They are being...
Yeah.
They
oh,
are
they are.
They're,
and, in fact, in England.
And they should
and
be.
Some of the Redbrook universities.
This is the best way for anyone to learn history. You know, when I was a kid in school, history was so dull and so dry. You just had to memorize a list of dates.
And wars.
And dates and wars and names Kings. Of people. And it didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. When you read one of Naida's books, you are just so drawn in to the people and the place that you just don't want to put it down. It's amazing.
Well, thank you. People do say they like that. I think it's the sociology in me. It isn't just history. It's how people lived, what they ate. Mm-hmm. There are different practices. And, yes, it has sexual practices that we were not familiar with. Because I was writing about life.
Yeah.
All of it, in all its aspects. And as I was saying to you in the break, the thing I did deliberately was in book one, which is Eye of the Bear, the main protagonists are the native people. However, and the Spanish, even though which became Mexicans during the time of the story, it was just nothing. They didn't know what it meant, and they still call themselves Españoles. But anyway, they were the enemies in the battles that ensued, and people don't realize that the native people did not always lose the wars. They won this one, and it changed the entire world, I would argue. I would argue that, I have it at the end of the book, An Eye of the Bear, why that is.
Hmm.
Very important part of our history. But the enemy is the Mexican or Espanoli. In River of Red Gold, the next book, he becomes the hero. And you have Pedro Valdez, very much the hero of that book. And the enemy in that book is Elisa Donner's first husband, who was a really sorry excuse for a human being.
Harry McCoon.
Right.
Yeah. And he was a real person.
And since they had no living descendants, I was able to call it like I saw it.
Good.
Everybody that mentioned him and all the historical records had something negative to say about him. He was vain, he was handsome, but he was dishonest down to the last nth degree and a mean drunk. And beat his first wife to death, and then married this 14-year-old, starving to death, and so forth. Eliza Donner. It was a tragic story.
Yeah, after
but
all,
his
she had been through.
yes,
with
she
a Donner party. Then
married him.
Perry McCoon.
Married
oh my goodness,
Perry McCoon.
Out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yes, and in charge of four little sisters at the same time.
Yeah.
And how all that works out. That's what makes River of Red Gold such a story.
It really
an incredible
is.
Story that has been not ever been told before.
Well, you know what, Naida? We have come to the end of our time, and we have not talked about Rest for the Wicked. Will you please just tell our audience where Rest of the Wicked begins and
why?
One sentence about the main character. And
but I need to say who the hero is in this, if there is one, is the son of Perry McCoon.
And it's Billy McCoon, and he's a good guy.
Billy McCoon, he's a good guy. He's half Indian. His mother is... because the two girls were both married to Perry McCoon, Eliza Donner and Indian Mary. That was her nickname. She was a real person.
These are real people.
There and Billy McCoon is a real person. But okay, what was this one sentence?
Well, where did Rest of the Wicked picks up River Red Gold stops.
Actually, it's a 40-year gap.
Oh, 40-year
gap. So a gap of 40 years.
And
so we've gone from 1853, and we begin in Rest for the Wicked in 18... Well, I cheat a little bit. There's a little bit from the 1870s, and but it really, really, really starts big in 1893 and ends in 1910. Now, why? I was telling the story of a very Western... part of the world, United States, which is California, and that story is it's the Old West in California. People think of the Old West as being in Idaho and Montana. It was here, it was the wildest of the West, right here. But I'm ending it in 1910 because that's when I think it ended.
Oh.
And why that is, maybe we need to discuss some other time.
Yes, and maybe you need to...
Well, Hiram Johnson was elected, and we suddenly got some regulation on the Southern Pacific Railroad. And we heard that strange R word that hadn't been spoken before.
Railroad?
Regulation.
Regulation. population.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I used to live near Hiram Johnson High School.
Oh, yes.
In Sacramento. I am so sorry. We have to stop. You're just going to have to come back one of these days. And in the meantime, folks, I suggest you, okay, you have a website.
www.bridgehousebooks.com. Bridge like crossing the bridge. House. Bridge House used to be the name of Rancho Murrieta. I'm trying to keep it alive. The developers changed it. And so it's bridgehousebooks.com.
And they'll find all about you mm-hmm. and your books mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. They can buy your books there. They mm-hmm. can order them. Mm-hmm. Can they still?
Oh, and I need to tell you where they can come and see me. I'm going to be on the 17th of December, Saturday, 1 to 4, I'm going to be across the street from where we're sitting right now at Heinen Company's bookstore.
Oh, fabulous.
Signing books and talking to people, and I hope some of you come on out. Also, my books are at some of the wineries, especially Soban at the moment, and usually they are at the Rancheria, the Jackson Rancheria. We'll see.
Okay.
That's supposed to be at Montevina and the Jackson Rancheria, but Soban for sure. They've got copies right now, I can tell you, and Heinen Company.
Okay.
On the main street of Jackson.
On the main street of Jackson, which is now decorated for Christmas, mm-hmm. and all the parking meters are covered mm-hmm. up. You don't have to feed the parking meters, so come on down and go to Jackson.
Oh, I like that. Yes, I saw it. Oh,
spend
wonderful.
Your money and help this economy. Come on, folks.
Yeah.
Hey, have a nice week. We'll be back again next week with Nan Mahon, who is a mystery writer and newspaper woman. She's very interesting. Hope you'll come back. It's been nice having you with us. This is Linda Field. Manzanita Voices. Take care.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.